Capital Allocators is brought to you by 10East, an investment platform for sophisticated investors to access private markets. 10East brings benefits of having your own family office without the cost and headaches of doing so. It's founded and led by Michael LaFell, former deputy executive managing member of Davidson Kempner. Michael and his investment team offer members the opportunity to co-invest by offering at their discretion. Michael and his team source, diligence, and commit material personal capital to each investment. The opportunities shared on the 10East platform offer exposure to private credit, real estate, niche venture and private equity, and other idiosyncratic investments that typically aren't available through traditional channels. The principals have over a decade track record of investing in these types of exposures across more than 350 transactions. Post-investment, the 10East team conducts ongoing monitoring and reporting, just as you'd expect from an institutional investment organization. I've known Michael for about a decade, and after becoming impressed by the quality of 10East offerings, its research process, and high-quality investment team, I became an advisor to the organization and investor in multiple offerings. You can learn more and join me as a member at 10east.co. That's the number 10east.co. Capital Allocators is brought to you by Enfusion. Enfusion simplifies investment management operations by uniting the front, middle, and back offices under a single SaaS-native platform built on a single golden data set. With Enfusion, you'll be able to simplify workflows, customize your capabilities, and collaborate seamlessly on everything from portfolio construction to accounting. You can launch new investment solutions, streamline compliance, and reduce manual processes in a platform that's continuously updated without disruption. Go beyond legacy technology and see why over 850 clients of every size and strategy trust Enfusion. Enfusion, the last upgrade you'll ever need. Learn more and request a demo today at enfusion.com.
Hello, I'm Ted Seides, and this is Capital Allocators. This show is an open exploration of the people and process behind capital allocation. Through conversations with leaders in the money game, we learn how these holders of the keys to the kingdom allocate their time and their capital. You can keep up to date by visiting CapitalAllocatorsPodcast.com. My guest on today's show is Margaret Chen, the head of CA Capital Management, Cambridge Associates' $20 billion outsourced chief investment officer business, or OCIO, as you'll hear. She spent 20 years at Cambridge Associates, which was her first and only stop in the investment business, after getting started in the working world as a management consultant at Coopers & Lybrand. Our conversation covers Margaret's career path, her evolution from a consultant to a principal, the value proposition of an OCIO, measuring performance, and the tension between being the same and being different for clients. Margaret has the ear of almost everyone in our field and brings incredible perspective to addressing the key issues allocators face. Please enjoy my conversation with Margaret Chen. Why don't we start talking about how someone who was the head of their Yale College class went to the Kennedy School of Government.
The Yale College Council.
Yale College Council. And went to the Kennedy School of Government, ended up in the investment business.
Yes. So completely serendipitous. And actually, I would say this is probably the best liberal arts story around, because I grew up with parents who immigrated to the U.S. who had no idea what a market was, you know, in terms of like the stock market, the bond market. And so, you know, what Yale for me was, we should say that we knew each other in college, but Yale for me was such an eye-opener. I mean, you got to a place where, talk about the world as your oyster, there was so much to learn and see. And I actually didn't actually take an investments class or even an economics class till sophomore year. And then that sort of like opened my eyes. But I My real interest at the time was political science. I was really interested in comparative politics. I was interested in so many things that ultimately actually gave me the skill set to be a very good investor. So, for example, analytical skills in political science are really important. You know, how do you do research? How do you do statistics? How do you do regressions? Like, all those things of trying to think about why people vote the way they do, for example, or how do institutions evolve into really high-functioning democracies? You know, like those kinds of things are really helpful when you're dealing with investments.
And as an aside, like, political science is clearly not a science.
Yes, that's right. It's a social science.
And that trans- I mean, there's a lot of investing that science, people from the outside think there's an answer.
Right.
But clearly there isn't.
And that's exactly right, is that investing is an art and you have to have judgment and wisdom and experience. And, you know, political science is the same thing. You can't predict people, you know, and institutions.
Clearly, what's going on these days.
Right.
And the plan was to go on a political science path.
Yes. The plan was to go into government of some sort, right? And so I, after doing the Yale College Council, which was a student government, and I was the second campus-wide elected president and, you know, the first woman to be elected, I thought, what am I going to do? And it was a full-time job. I mean, so I actually had reduced my course load to do this. And Edward Tufte, who many people may know, but he started
the thesis advisor.
And he was my thesis advisor. And so he, you know, he did the envisioning information, and he really was very instrumental because I love the fact of data with design. And he basically said, why don't you go to the Kennedy School? Now, this is I graduated in 1990. And so we came out right on the verge of a recession, and it was really hard to get a job. And I was like, well, I was doing the student government thing. I could get a job, or I could do something else, like go to law school, go work. And he said, why don't you think about the Kennedy School? And I was like, what's the Kennedy School? Or what's the public policy school? And it was actually, for me, I'm very interdisciplinary, and it was a very good match of public versus private partnership, and that's what I really attracted me to it. And so I went, and I was one of the very youngest ones in the class, so there was a plus and a minus to that. The minus was that all your bad habits in college, you know, in terms of studying and stuff, carried over, so you didn't have a break. And the plus was that I was very hungry to learn from people who had a lot more experience than me. Really loved the Kennedy School. From there, I actually did management consulting because you had to sort of major or minor, and I did transportation, another public-private partnership. Really ultimately led me to management consulting, and there I was doing a lot of economics finance work. So what happens if two airlines merge? What happens to their routes? And so one day a light bulb went off. I've been apprenticed for years before I realized that the light bulb went off, like, I want to do investing. And so in one day, so I started talking to people, and in one day, it took me almost 18 months, three people told me about Cambridge Associates. In the same day.
Who were those three people, do you remember?
Well, I remember two of them, and one whose name I no longer remember. One was Troy Murray, who was a very, very long time employee at Cambridge Associates and a wonderful person, and also a Yale grad. And so I had been president of the Yale Club of Boston, and I'd known him for 8 years, and I had no idea what he did. This is like a young person saying, like, yeah, he's my friend. I have no idea what he did. Another person was Heidi Perlson from Adamus Partners, and who worked at Cambridge, but she had interned at Coopers & Lybrand Consulting, which is where I was working. And so through that, she had said, you know, what about Cambridge Associates? And so, you know, in that one day, and I was like, what is this firm? So I called them up, and they basically were kind enough to interview me. They put me through 14 interviews, then told me, Troy called me from London and said, you know, everyone really enjoyed you, but, you know, you'd be a high-risk hire. Which is very nice of him to say. And I said, I basically made a case for why you should give me a chance. And it's been a fabulous fit. And actually, it was in 1997. And so in 3 days, it's going to be my 20th anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
That's very exciting.
It's like yesterday.
So 20 years at Cambridge, and a lot's changed. And you're learning for the business of consulting, the OCIO business, which we'll talk about. Why don't you touch a little bit on your path within Cambridge? So how did you start? And let's evolve that to where we are today.
Yeah, I mean, it's very different. It was very different in the late 90s. The investing world was very different. When I started at Cambridge, the path was you worked with, let's say, 10 colleagues who were more senior than you, and it really was an apprentice model. I mean, this doesn't happen anymore because the world has changed so differently. Technology has changed things, and investments have changed. But back then, you could work with 10 people, and you work with a multitude of different kinds of clients. So the learning curve, it was like entering college again. It was so steep, you know, and you could learn one day you can be dealing with currency. The next day you could be dealing with this very large multinational endowment. The next day you could be, you know, working on specifically writing something about doing due diligence for a manager. I mean, it was just like being bombarded. And so it was incredibly exciting and really just learning from other people, learning from our clients. So that was for several years what I did. And I was very happy doing that. You know, that's a they're paying me to really, and I mean, of course, I came in with skills that were very helpful for the clients in the sense of, you know, the consultant management consulting is actually excellent for process and being able to take a institution or a group of people through a decision, you know, and so advocating for a recommendation. Those are really important skills because you can have the most fabulous ideas, but if no one buys into it, it doesn't matter.
And are there a few simple tools that you could think about of how you walk someone through a decision?
Yeah, I mean, the way I think is most important is if you have to understand and you have to appreciate who your audience is. I mean, that's like, it's so basic, but oftentimes folks know what works for them and they extrapolate that to everything else. You know, that's the only way to do it. But really, if you turn it around and just say, knowing Ted, you know, what is it that would appeal to Ted in terms of how I communicated this information? So, you know, some people are very visual, some people are very literal, some people are a combination, some people are very analytical, and some people, you know, just want to have you talk about it and hear you have the conviction. And so you have to be able to really think through those kinds of things. And that seems very simple, but people have hired us to be independent thinkers and to provide them information with what we think should be best for the portfolio. You know, half the battle is being able to get yourself heard.
At some point in time, as you go through this broad and deep learning process, the business starts to grow and people get siloed. Where did you end up plugging in after you went through your 4, 6, 8 years, whatever it was, of education?
Very early on, I was lucky enough to find a set of clients that really appealed to me, and it was a business that I built. So it was just, you know, serendipitous, but it actually suited my skill set. So I ended up with a client that was a liquidating pool. So instead of, you know, here's a pot of money, and as an endowment, you want to grow into perpetuity, I had these set of clients where, for whatever reason, either for environmental reasons, settlement reasons, spend on reasons, you know, these are, and this is sort of ahead of their time, we were talking 15 years ago, that they had a large pool of money, and 35, 40 years from now, they're going to go down to zero. And how do you get them to zero when there's uncertain spending? Some of these are very highly taxable. Some of these have significant strains on what they can invest in, and they're capital preservation oriented. So there's some aspect of endowment oriented because they're long-term horizon. There's some aspect of pensions because they're somehow asset liability, but in a very loose way. And some of them are highly taxable, like private clients. So I had a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And that was very important because it was allowed me to be very innovative and think about how to deal with these kinds of pools. So that, you know, I was basically the CIO, and it was for these set of clients for many, many years. And that, I think, informed a lot of how I evolved as an investor. And it allowed me to think outside the box. I could look and say, well, what are the best practices out there, and apply them in a way that was very unique.
And that particular challenge is very different from how a perpetual pool or an endowment foundation pool, pension pool that's not perpetual but very long dated. You know, you have a pool that's winding down in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. What are the differences in how you'd think about an asset allocation structure or yield versus total return in that type of a challenge?
Well, that's a great question. So the most important concept that I always wanted to, you know, make sure we protected against was the first phase, whatever that is, one, two, three, five, whatever that first phase is the absolute most important critical phase. Because if you don't get that right, then you don't get the other two thirds or three quarters of the, you know, of the decision right. It depends on the spending that's going to go out. It depends on what you think the expected needs are on the draw on the pool. So talk about like thinking about 2008 or even an endowment. I mean, the liquidity and the credit quality is really, really important. I mean, that's the you know, you have to constantly be vigilant about that, because it's so easy to be like, well, the S&P is up 33. Why don't we have 80% of this in, you know, the S&P? But you also have to invest for growth, right? And so there's a balance there that you have to think about. And it's not unlike an endowment where you're, you know, you have to think about long-term pool, but you have to think about liquidity, you know, spending, what your expected return needs to be, and how do you actually put those puzzle pieces together. And that's what it is. It's a puzzle, because everyone's different.
And relative to a foundation that spends 5% or endowment that's something similar, presumably the spending's higher.
Yes,
in these
a lot
pools.
Higher. Yes.
And so if you took it your average nonprofit asset allocation, very equity-oriented, very diversified, what does it do to the structure of the pool in general if you know the spending needs are higher than a different type of pool?
Yeah. So first, let me just say, for an emotional aspect, you have to be comfortable that the dollar value is going down.
Yeah.
You have to look at it, and you have to be okay that, you know, maybe you had $1 billion, you know, X years ago, and now you have 500. And that has to be okay. That is really hard for people when everyone is conditioned from birth to think that the higher
more,
the number, the better, right? So that's
really
the first thing.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is that you have to judge yourself differently. And I actually think, even for our Cambridge clients, it's really hard to benchmark yourself against your own personal appropriate benchmark. Like, folks say that we have a policy benchmark, and that's the, you know, that's what you should be benchmarking against yourself. But it's really hard, because we live in a world where everyone's like, well, how did you do, Ted? And what did you guys get in your portfolio?
Well, I own Bitcoin, Margaret. I'm doing just fine.
You did great. Exactly. So that, I think that's, you know, that was a really important thing. And then the third is that you have to know what you're investing for. So are we investing for yield, or are we investing for total return? You know, and we invested for total return because we have a time horizon. So as long as you had the liquidity and could accommodate near-term liquidity, we could invest for total return. And so we did do that. But primarily, I mean, there's a lot of fixed income. And we try to ladder what we can early on, but...
Probably less privates and...
Yes, exactly.
And more fixed income. Yep. That makes sense. And so with that core work... became a thing for you, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Within Cambridge.
And it allowed me to build a business. So I should probably say that my parents, because they came here as immigrants, you know, built businesses. You know, so my dad came here with nothing, you know, from Taiwan. And he, when he got here, he had no money. So he went and was a dishwasher in San Francisco and paid back, you know, loans to get, you know, for family members who lent him money to get here. So he ended up, you know, going to University of Kansas. So I'm a Jayhawks fan. And then at Columbia and getting a PhD and in engineering. But he ultimately started his own engineering company when I was in high school. So watching this, we were about to go to college in a couple of years. We're like, do we have enough money to, you know, go to college, my twin sister and me? And then my mother started a gift shop herself when I was about five. So I grew up in an environment where my parents, who were, you know, role models when you're a child, started things. And so at Cambridge, you know, I started this business, and I learned how to develop teams. I learned how to really develop people. I learned how to be a manager. And those are skill sets that I think, it makes me a little bit sad, because when I look around at trustees today, there's so many of even our peers who earn so much wealth at a very young age. Instead of going through the training program and going through the apprentice, you know, everyone says yes to you because you have been so successful so early. And this is the plus and the downside of you know, our technological change.
And let's talk a little bit about the consulting business. What is it? Cambridge, in my early years, was the place that everybody went in the endowment foundation world, and still is a great brand in the business. How does the consulting model work?
Well, consulting in some fields today feels like a dirty word, like derivatives. But consulting is really important, I think, as a for the right kind of client. Consulting is having a consultant is really important. And that client is the client that has a strong core in terms of an investment committee and a staff and needs resources. And whether it's manager information, whether it's ideas, whether it's best practices, whether it's benchmarking, I mean, those, you have to get those someplace. Because in itself, you know, if you just had, say, an investment staff and an investment committee, I mean, you have a volunteer group and you have a staff that could be very high quality, but they're going to turn over. I mean, just by definition. And that's, you know, because the people, that's the career path. And so they're not the resources, and there's not the institutional history. And so there's a real place for that. And that's how Cambridge got started, you know. And so, you know, Jim Bailey and Hunter Lewis had the foresight to first hire very good people. And, you know, Jim will tell you he was one of the early ones to hire all the women that no one was hiring in the 70s. But that skill set is very important. Now, the world has changed significantly. And we as a firm have also evolved. And the structure of having investment committees that are sort of permanent investment committee members, as it were, the few folks that stay on for a long time with the institution, and a staff that really stays on for a long time. I mean, you don't get the Scott Malpasses of the world. You don't get the Andy Goldens. You know, you don't get the David Swensons. Like that they're like the outliers now, whereas they used to be the norm. And so the need for consultants has changed, and our clients started asking us to evolve into an investment office and to be their outsourced investment office. And that's how we actually got started in the business, because in 2000, our very first client said, you know, can you just do this for us? Because, you know, they got tired of hiring people that left, or they couldn't keep their investment committees. You know, they termed out, or they, you know, it was hard to recruit folks. So that's how it got started. And then in 2005, we had our first total portfolio, you know, a very large foundation. And that's where the business has evolved. And it's filled a really important place when investments have gotten more complex. I mean, investing has gotten more complex. Yeah.
On the OCIO business that you run today, there are a lot of different structures that people can use. Right? You can have one pool, everyone invests in the same pool. You can have asset class pools. You can have customized portfolios for each client. And you can have some combination of all of those. How did you guys approach it, and how has that evolved?
It was very simple. The way I thought about it was, if I were starting an investment office, what would I want? Right. And so there's sort of what I would call three flavors. So if you think of yourself as a builder, let's say you're building a house, right? Everyone has the same house. You're building the exact same house. There's no difference. Everyone's got the white picket fence. And so that to me is more of a product kind of thing, right? There are those that you're in the same neighborhood, but you might have different kinds of houses. So you say you'll have your colonial or split level. And so that might be the asset class sleeves combination, right? So you're creating a portfolio, you know, like that. The way I thought was most important and most appropriate for an institution was that I'd want to know, you know, what does that institution need? What is it that I, as an institution, need from my portfolio? That's unique to me. And so we are able to provide them with a full investment office, not just an investment team, because in some ways that's the easiest part, but you have to have what I call the institution, and you have to have the infrastructure. You want to know that who you hire is going to be around, and that it's not, that you're not going to have to deal with transition, succession, you know. And you also want to have the infrastructure. So today, because of the investing environment, the regulations, you need compliance, trading, legal, oversight, monitoring, you know, accounting, reporting. I mean, those you have to buy someplace. I mean, that just comes with the business today. And so the ability to provide that back office infrastructure, research, plus the institutional stability and the reputation, plus, you know, the investment team, is how we went around building the house.
Yeah.
And our clients, actually, I would say almost a third of them have some sort of unique, what folks would call mission-oriented SRI, you know, whether it's minority managers or whether it's environmental. And then that makes it harder to do the first two options, because you need to really have a portfolio that reflects your own mission.
Yeah. So does that mean that each client kind of has their own portfolio?
Yes. Every client has its own portfolio. It's customized to that client's needs. And we spend a lot of time, you know, working with clients to understand what is going on at that institution. So the whole enterprise. Because oftentimes, if there's debt covenants out there and you don't know about that, you'd invest differently.
Yeah.
You know? Or if there's, you know, for universities, you know, there's a lot of fossil fuel issues out there. You know, if you're not aware of what's going on out there, you might need, yeah. So those are the kinds of things that when we started investing, like that wasn't no one really talked about.
And what are the other challenges? There's always this question of, oh, you're a consultant, you're effectively recommending managers. You know, I sit on an investment committee effectively run by Cambridge Associates. How different is it from when you are structuring the portfolio, making the recommendations of managers, to you are now the decision maker?
I think intellectually, there is not much difference in the sense that, you know, when you're putting a recommendation forth, it needs to be the best recommendation you can make and for all the thought process that you've gone through. The difference really is in execution. So when you have to own that decision, the performance is on you. That is different, right? So, you know, 25 years ago, there was a partnership. It was a partnership with the committee, and everyone had to own it together. But really, in terms of the actual ownership, the investment committee owned the decisions. And over time, probably because of, you know, how the investment committees evolved, how these institutions evolved, all the wealth creation that's happened, the onus shifted to Cambridge Associates. And that has continued to happen. And so because of that, we recognize that that was really important. And so in order to do that, you have to have the infrastructure to do that. You have to have and be able to allow folks to and to acknowledge and call it out and say, look, now it's not a partnership where, yes, you know, you, the investment committee, still has the vote, but, you know, the performance is on us. If we own it, we have to own it. And that's where the change is. So is it different? I would say the mechanism of making the recommendations is not different, but actually making the managing the portfolio, underwriting the managers, and ultimately execution and having that monitoring oversight, you know, that is what we can provide to clients that are very different.
How do you think about the business and scaling the business?
Well, we do it differently than others. So we have investment teams that are focused by types of clients they work with. It's focused on geography and then just, you know, capacity. So we have multiple, and there's a matchmaking that goes on because we're talking about investments. You know, we're talking about matching skill sets and expertise to an institution. And that's my job. So I always tell prospective clients, you have to buy the institution first. Like, you have to be able to say, you know, CA Capital as my OCIO provider is the right fit for me. The criteria that we've just talked about, you want, you know, resources, stability, experience, investment team, you need a whole investment office. You know, if those are all your criteria, then you're in the right place and you can say, okay, who would be the right fit for me? And it's so interesting because I deal with this concept of sameness versus being different in every aspect. And this is one of those where I think institutions want to be different, and yet it's very hard to be different. You know, so you look at the numbers that come out every fiscal year as to how everyone's performed, and it's, you know, you're comparing yourself against your peers, but that's not how you're investing. You're investing against your own benchmark for a reason. And we tell our children that. You know, we tell our children to, you know, be yourself, and yet you sort of can. Sure. So that's the tension that I think exists out there. And for us, you know, the monitoring and oversight is really important because we may have multiple teams, but we're shared the same builder, the investment philosophy and investment approach, the process by which we ensure all of our investment teams execute, you know, their decisions is all the same. So the infrastructure, the institution is all the same. So then it's a matter of, okay, you know, what are the, what's the right risk tolerance? What is the right asset allocation? What are the right managers? But I, you know, from a monitoring and oversight, it's really important for us, you know, and this is why I see every portfolio, I see every trade, and you can, you know, you look through it and you can see actually, you know, we do have that core consistency in terms of the institution and the infrastructure.
What are the core investment beliefs that come across all of these portfolios?
Well, we have an equity bias. We, you know, there's no question about that. We also, you know, the core beliefs are, you know, we are diversified. We do believe in diversification. And, you know, it's been a very challenging environment to invest in the last, you know, 8 years or so. But we've lived through it before the tech crisis. It was the same thing as one sector, but, you know. So in our lifetimes, it's been challenging to be a diversified investor. But there's no question that, you know, being protective of the whole institution and the endowment requires some diversification. So we can argue about how much diversification, but as a concept, it is something that we truly believe.
Yeah. And if you dig in, so I, you know, I've scratched my head on this probably more than most people have because of what's happened over the last 10 years. But Warren Buffett says U.S. is just fine. You know, the S&P is plenty diversified. And yeah, it's easy for all of us to look back and say, oh,
of course it's right.
Oh, if only. Of course the U.S. is the best economy. Of course it's the best market. Do people rethink that? Most of these portfolios are globally diversified. They're equity biased, but across asset classes. Is there anyone that in your conversations with the many institutions that you work with that have said, no, U.S. equities is just fine for us. Thank you very much.
Well, I think there's a couple ways to answer that. One is that the stocks in the, say, the S&P are multinational companies, right? So they're not just U.S. companies. They happen to be U.S. domiciled, but they and much of their revenue can come from abroad.
Sure. Even better.
Even so better, right?
So another reason to stick to
exactly.
the S&P.
And second, we're U.S. dollar investors. So that's another reason.
Even better.
Right? But the reality is when you go, you know, if anyone has spent any time abroad, you know, let's say you go to Asia, you go to Latin America, you go to Europe, the world actually is different. If you ever pick up a paper and you say, you know, read the front page, you think you were in another, you know, like literally, you know, you're like, wow, things are very different outside the U.S. And so in the U.S., we have a luxury of being very stable. This is where the political science background comes in. We're very stable. We have a lot of wealth creation. We've had a lot of innovation. And we'll continue to do that. But the rest of the world, they become more like the U.S. in many, many ways. And so I think folks would say, yeah, you could do that. That's perfectly fine to be just in the S&P and say you have cash or fixed income. But just like we wouldn't think that we'd be having an iPhone that has more power than our, you know, than the mainframe computer in the 70s, like, things change and you have to adapt to that. And so as a business, you know, for our clients, we're in the business of adapting and evolving. And you have to because, you know, the world changes.
What are the challenges that you face in having multiple clients where you want to put the best portfolios for their clients together, and yet the more assets you're managing, it's a similar problem. Like the larger you get, the more your investable universe can shrink.
Well, let me just say, I think having multiple clients is a gift. Because it's like the whole going to college again. The lessons you can learn very quickly from having multiple clients, the learning curve is, it's amazing. Like you can immediately see, so we can spot sort of trends or we can spot best practices much faster because you see many, many clients. So there's a real advantage doing that. From an investing standpoint, I would argue that that is not actually size as itself and I think you're asking a question about access, is not an issue. In the sense that our belief is that there's not a fixed number of managers out there. So if there were a fixed number of high quality managers out there, yes, everyone would be competing for the same. But if you're a very large pension, you're not playing the same space as a, you know, $500 million, $250 million endowment because your dollars that you have to put to work on a percentage basis are so much bigger. So you might be in very, very large, much larger funds. You know, so those sovereign wealth funds, I mean, they're multi-billions of dollars. That's a completely different way of investing. So in some ways, then you have to go, well, the competition then is amongst either, you know, if you were mid-size and you wanted to do privates, you know, or if you're smaller, the access is a little bit harder. You have to do it, you know, through some vehicle. So what we have found in doing our research is that there are people innovating and coming and, you know, starting businesses every day. So if you look at sort of the top performing private funds, they may not be the same as they are 20 years from now. Well, they won't be the same, you know, 20 from now and 20 years previous. And so there's always this, I don't subscribe to a fixed pool. I do think that there's always a growth and dynamic innovation in terms of investing. So if there's a need, there's going to be a demand. And I think that one of the things that Cambridge does best is actually doing the manager research. And we, because we have that 45 plus year history, you know, we know the analyst that was at X fund. And that 5-7 years from now, if that person wants to start a fund, like we know where that pedigree comes from. You know, and that's a big advantage.
As we've had this proliferation, particularly in the public markets, of ways of accessing exposures for less, so the whole ETF movement, the factor movement, have you thought about incorporating more of those sort of low-cost direct approaches in your portfolios in a way that you may not have in the past if it was just, hey, we're going to just go find the best managers we can for our clients?
We are not averse to that, you know, in the sense of anything that can either enhance the return of the portfolio in any way and, you know, on a risk-adjusted basis. So whether it be through reducing fees, whether it be through, you know, synthetic exposure, whether it be just, you know, execution, like all of that is on the table. It also depends on the client too. There's some clients that really have issues with more new strategies. So we work with what we have and, you know, but I would say there's no, you know, we don't have a can't have this kind of thing.
What happens in a particular example, let's say there's a new, let's call it a hedge fund, it doesn't matter, long only fund, private equity fund, that you've known as an organization because they came out of a place you'd supported for you, you know the person, you want to get behind them, but there's limited capacity. And you have CA Capital Management, the OCIO business, you have lots of consulting clients. Is there a conflict or is there a mechanism, and what's the mechanism to decide who gets access to something that has limited capacity?
So the mechanism is pretty straightforward, and that has to do with, you know, we ensure we're compliant too, but the manager decides. So that fund, the GP, decides who ultimately, as the manager does for any client outside of Cambridge or, you know, within Cambridge, who gets access, which institution gets access. It would be a complete conflict of interest if we had to pick and choose amongst our clients. It's like saying, who's your favorite child? You can't do that. But what you can do is saying your child's applying to school, and you say, okay, you know, the school has to decide how to make that composition amongst their LPs. What is that right composition? Having said that, I will say that I think we have really good access because people want to be with our clients. And because we are not a one-size-fits-all kind of OCIO shop, then basically, you know, we are not looked at as one entity. You're looking at it and you say, well, what about this endowment? What can this endowment bring or this institution? So that's what, you know, we've worked very long with many, many managers, and the process works because it's fair, because it's transparent, and because, you know, Cambridge is not one large entity in that sense. It has a name, but aside from having the infrastructure, it has, you know, many underlying different children.
How do you think about measuring performance of your own teams?
Well, there's the qualitative factor and there's a quantitative factor. So the quantitative is fairly simple. We look at performance versus policy benchmark. And that's why we spend a lot of time working with our teams and working with clients to ensure we have, you know, an acceptable and agreeable policy benchmark. So that part is fairly straightforward. The harder part is the people management of it, right? And so there are a variety of factors. So the client, making sure that they're communicating with the client very, very well. And the client understands the expectations and there's good dialogue on what's going on in the portfolio that they feel, you know, they feel as invested in us as we're invested in them. Because this is a long-term proposition. If you're going to do it, it's not a good fit for us if every 2 or 3 years you want to change your OCIO provider. Because you're not going to get good returns.
Sure.
You know, investing is a long-term approach. But, you know, you just have to buy into the philosophy. If you're buying into the philosophy, like we've had clients where, you know, they were an index and then they wanted to decide they wanted to, you know, come to Cambridge and really appreciate a diversified portfolio. We've also had the other way. You know, you're like, we built you this fantastic portfolio knowing that when they terminate us, they're going to be hitting the wrong time in the index, and we see it, and that's, you know, that's the way it is. So we say, I think it's really important to do the homework. You know, make sure they come on site and understand like what approach and the process that we take. So the second thing is on the qualitative aspect of it, making sure that the teams have an underlying process that we can replicate. You know, so regardless of whether it's the decision that they make, not only do they feel like they have conviction, but they also have real conviction in how they got to that decision so that they can own that decision and that they understand how it interacts in the whole portfolio. Because what we're trying to do is, you know, we're trying to earn a certain kind of certain return for a client. And so how the team works together, you know, the investment decisions they make, the process, how are you a corporate citizen? Are you sharing? One of the advantages of working with Cambridge is that it's really lonely being a CIO. And so if you're a CIO at an institution, sort of no one's really going to want to talk to you and tell you your secrets. But we have the CIOs get together every month. They talk about investment issues. They can talk about what they're hearing from their clients. And that's a real benefit, because then all of a sudden you can say, I am struggling with the same thing. You know, whether it's a manager, whether it's an issue, a question from a client, you know, whether it's a market, concern, and you can talk through it. And by virtue of clearing your head and getting some comfort in uncertainty, and that others are in the same boat that you are, really helps. And that really makes you more focused as an investor, and that helps you get better long-term, returns.
One of the things I was always curious about in a model where you have a deep research team that's separate from the CIO is how do you get conviction in individual decisions? Because I know when I sat in the seat, even if you had a small research team, you always wanted to be in front of the portfolio manager so you can use your own instinct and experience to say, yeah, this is someone I want to have in my portfolio. In a bigger organization, when you have dedicated research teams, I just from the outside, I imagine that can't always happen. You can't have every CIO sitting with every portfolio manager.
We don't have every CIO, but you have an investment team member having met with the manager. Because what we do at Cambridge is we have a dedicated research manager, research team and research group that's global. But we also have, it's a partnership model. So investment team members can go to any meeting. And so if you're investing in that manager, managers cycle through many of our offices, but we're also on the road all the time. So there will be always an investment team person who has seen a manager. We won't invest in a manager that we have not seen. And so therefore, you have almost a double check, right? Because you have all the proper due diligence that we've done on a manager, and that's done by our research team. And then on that, then the next question is it the right fit for the portfolio for that institution? And that is what the institutional, that's what the investment team member has to decide.
And what does the manager see then from the other side of the table? So they've seen a research team come in, they have this CIO
But what they tell us is this. What they tell us is, look, they really appreciate, it can be a lot of work relative to other competitors out there, but it's worth it because they know that we appreciate and understand what it is they do. And we have long-term investors. And they have clients that have basically bought into what Cambridge offers and are there for the long term. I mean, we have a 97% retention rate for the last five, over the last 5 years. And I think the average tenure is something like 12 years. So these are institutions that are not going anywhere. They believe in long-term investing. They believe in diversification. They believe in the structure and the infrastructure that we provide them. And the managers appreciate that. So we might put them through their paces, but managers tell us that they appreciate it in the long run. It's like, it was worth it.
And then does that translate to the tendency to hang around for a long time with managers, or can individual CIOs on a team decide, I no longer like that particular manager in my portfolio?
Yeah, so there are two levels on that too. So the research team will ultimately make a research decision on a manager. So there's, they go through under regular due diligence. On a second level, the investment team could also decide for investment for that specific client need that the manager is no longer appropriate for the portfolio. It could be for a variety of reasons. It could be you're cutting real assets, and so you have to figure out which manager to trim. It could be that you find a better fit for a risk return profile. It could be, there are lots of legitimate reasons why that could be the case. But then and we do allow the teams to make individual decisions on managers. And the reason is because I don't think in investing there is a standard A to B. Managers, that is again, you're hiring an investment team and you can get the same return and, get there differently. So I think in that sense, this is where the sameness and different being different is there's always a tension there, and we're comfortable living with that because I think that every institution is different, and so if you're different, you have to allow the investment teams to have that difference. And again, if you have the proper monitoring and oversight, that's fine. We see all the managers in the portfolio, so I can tell you where the overlap is and where it's not.
What are the trends in the OCIO business? So if you were to look out 5 or 10 years from now, What do you think your business looks like, and what does this sort of industry of OCIOs look like?
If we looked out 5-10 years, I'd say we're in the early innings in the sense of there will be consolidation in the industry. And there will be a consolidation of models, you know, in terms of, you know, what clients want in terms of their OCIO provider. You know, there's so many providers now. The barriers to entry in some ways are still relatively low, and they're getting higher. They're getting higher because you need the infrastructure, you need the resources, you need to invest in those. So, but in the early days, you know, anyone can hang on a shingle and you know, you can outsource a lot of the back office. But more and more clients, I think, are realizing the reason they want to hire an outsourced investment office and the concept and the model, sort of the way that we provide our clients a full investment office. It's not just the investment team. It's everything around it that's really complex. And some of it's so manual, you know, even today. And that is actually very different. And a lot of folks don't appreciate that because they don't see it. Like, if you keep the trains running, that's not, you know, everyone's like, of course you got the trains running. But the minute it doesn't, you know, work, like, you know, in 2008, a lot of it went off the rails. You see where those cracks are. So I think that's in 5-10 years, that's what we're going to see.
If you look back in the early 70s, I guess it was in Boston, Endowment Management and Research was sort of this original OCIO business. I think they managed Yale's endowment. And then when you went through that difficult period in the markets in the 70s and the purchasing power of these pools got crushed, that took what was an early OCIO model and turned it back into individual investment offices. Are there any lessons that you guys thought about as you were moving into that from the failure of the first wave of OCIO businesses to make sure that whatever happened then won't happen again this time around?
That's a good question, Ted. I think one of the things that has changed is when that model failed, it forced people to hire their own. The fact that, you know, David Swensen or Scott Malpass were hired in their 20s and early 30s, that won't happen today again. But that's what forced folks to say, you know what, we want our own CIO. We want to build our own team because we will know what they're investing in. We will have some say and some control over what they're investing in and some provide some guidance. You know, today, in some ways, because technology is so good, and also because the outsourcing as in our daily lives is just a fact of life, folks are just much more comfortable with saying, you know what, I'm going to hire a specialist, you know, for X, Y, and Z, including my endowment. And as long as that communication mechanism and that information interchange and that, you know, you have confidence that your CIO and investment team understand and not only, like, we feel that we are part of those institutions. Like, we may be, say, Capital or Cambridge Associates, but we feel that we are, you know, at that institution's investment office, you know, just down the hall from the CFO or the president. That's what you want, you know, because then it really doesn't matter where you are, you know, as long as you see them regularly. But I think that's, in some ways, we've come full circle, right? Because because of the world's changed.
What are the biggest challenges you see going forward?
I think there are two challenges. One is making sure folks have enough experience to be really strong investors, but be open-minded enough to continue learning. Because I think that since we have graduated from college, wealth creation has been incredible. Almost seems too easy out there for institutions as well as individuals. And in some ways, I worry that that leads to sort of a yes culture. You know, so, you know, if I have the means and I'm giving and being philanthropic, which is a wonderful aspect, you know, of one's life, you also have the power. And, you know, we're talking about power all over today, you know, in workforce. And I think that if you always feel that and know and have that and people treat you that you're like you're always right, it's actually very dangerous for investing. And so it's a variable of the dominant voice in the room problem. But when you have 5 dominant voices in the room, sometimes they can't get along. So, you know, one of the challenges is, you know, those kinds of individuals. And the second is, I think that since in the 25 years, you know, I've been in the business, I would say civility and gratitude are things that I worry about because I don't think people are very civil. And I think that people, if they don't like it, they'll leave, you know, instead of sort of working out and saying, well, Ted, why do you think that? You know, what is it that makes you think that? That's something that what makes me worried, because it leads to poor decision making. You know, from hiring your OCIO provider to deciding whether your performance is acceptable to just basically not serving the institution well if you're a trustee, or even if you're a staff person. When you come from one lens and one funnel and one perspective, you worry that you aren't doing right by the institution.
What do you see yourself doing 10 years from now?
Well, okay, so next year is a big year because I'm turning the big 5-0.
Oh, my gosh.
So 10 years, I think, in some ways, is like tomorrow. If I think back 10 years, I'd be like, oh, my gosh, you know, it's like they got a long ways to go. And now I think it's not that long. So I would say, you know, at different points in my career, I wondered, you know, is Cambridge the right place for me? But Cambridge has been tremendous in the sense of it's allowed me to have different careers at one place. And the older I get, the more I would not give up our clients and I wouldn't give up my colleagues. I mean, it's a tremendous group of individuals and institutions. And there's an aspect for me of giving back and serving. And this is my way of doing that. So it's not to say that I would or wouldn't be at Cambridge, but anything I do will have that element to it. And it's important to me.
Great. Well, Margaret, let's turn to a few fun closing questions. What was your favorite sports moment, either as a participant, which might be intramural ping pong, I'm not sure, or as a fan?
That is exactly what it was. That was my favorite sports moment. Was my own personal sports moment was intramural ping pong at college. We won the team cup for it. But actually, I will tell you actually what was the most intramural for me athletically was. Because I was an immigrant, we loved baseball. I mean, I loved the Yankees growing up, but I knew nothing about football. And so freshman year, like second week of school, I must have been in shorts and sneakers, and some guy comes up to me and says, you know, we are so desperate for a woman to come out because it was co-ed touch football, and we're going to forfeit the game if we don't have another woman come out. And so, you know, I was in shorts and sneakers, so I must look like I could run or something. And so I was like, and I didn't have the heart to tell him I knew nothing about football. Like literally nothing. I didn't even know where the end zone was. So we get out there. I said, okay, fine. So I get out there, and he says, just go to your right and just run straight and then just turn around and I'm going to throw you the ball. Because after watching me a couple plays, you could see that I could run. So I did that. I caught the ball, and then I knew enough to be like, I have to run to the end zone. But I just started running the other way, and then everyone's yelling, and it was because I was already in the end zone. So I learned football really fast. So that was great.
What teaching from your parents has most stayed with you?
To be self-sufficient. My parents are, I think because they were immigrants and they came with very little, it was very important to them to tell their three daughters that to be self-sufficient and independent was very, very important. And they even said to the point, I remember our conversation, they're like, you can never depend on a guy. You know, you have to, and they don't mean it in that sense, but they meant in a financial sense, in the sense that it was really important to do that.
What information do you read that other people might not know about?
The most favorite thing I read is The New Yorker. I think The New Yorker by far gives me the best bang for my buck in terms of the time I have, the variety and diversification of stories, the excellent writing that I hardly see anymore, you know, and I used to love The Wall Street Journal and New York Times when they write these big, deep articles. They run a business too, and they just, you know, it's hard to be able to have the money to do that. And I think, you know, for me, as I've gotten older, I'm very interested in people and sort of what other perspectives people bring. So I do love reading books about people, and I love reading autobiographies. But the reality is also that I have to limit myself because I will literally stay up till 4 a.m. finishing a book. So it's a bad quality.
What life lesson have you learned that you wish you knew a lot earlier in life?
To just slow down, you know, and we all run around doing so much. And it's not that that's not a good thing. It's that no one spends the time and smells the roses and goes, you know what, that was really awesome. And just taking the time to do that, I think, brings a measure of satisfaction and happiness to life, especially if something's particularly challenging, to be able to do, that's okay. And also, you know, failing is okay. You know, this is a culture where people do not, you know, feel very shamed for failing. And I think for me, I'm like, yeah, I failed lots of things and that's okay. I learned to pick myself up and just move on and say, you know what, there's always tomorrow.
All right, last one. It is your waning days. You are 90 years old, creating whatever next business you're going to create. Looking back on your life, what advice would you give yourself today?
I would say it's so important to learn something new. I have forced myself because I had to. In, you know, when my kids were learning how to ice skate, I was like, I have from New Jersey. My parents from Taiwan. I've never learned how to ice skate. So I forced myself to learn how to ice skate. I did it for 6 years. And accomplishing the ability to skate well is great. In my 40s, I learned to cross-country ski because my kids are doing it. My husband loves it, and I had resisted. And I love cold weather. But like being on skis, if you've never been on skis as an adult, is the most challenging thing ever. And then now, I basically am taking adult ballet. And I'm also learning Mandarin. I can speak basic restaurant Mandarin, but I want to get better. And it's so humbling to learn something new. So I encourage everybody to pick one thing, and you're going to feel like you're 5 or 10 again and have that anxiety, like, I got to be good at that. And that's such a good feeling, because when you actually improve, whether it's running or anything, you know, it really makes you feel alive.
Margaret, thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Ted.
Thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you found a nugget or two to take away and apply in your investing and your life. If you've liked what you've heard, please write a review on iTunes or Google Play to help others find out about the show. Have a good one, and see you next time.